Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on and about the environment, our impacts and relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak. Co-host this week is Melissa Marstead. And joining us, as always, sometime around the equinox and the solstice, and this is the equinox, is Brian McInerney, senior hydrologist with the National Weather Service. And he's here to talk all things weather and some trends in climate and conditions of our reservoirs and burn scars and debris flows. Lots to cover in the next 20 minutes or so. So, Brian, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Let's start as we usually do. Let's look back 3 months. Climatological summer. That's June, July, and August. How did we fare temperature and precipitation-wise?
You know, if you look at this year, what you find is we had such an active winter and such a cold, wet spring all the way through May. And it stayed cold in June, colder than average, what you typically see in June. And then it was about average in July, and then August was really quite warm. With that, it was pretty much dry all summer long. It was like the tap got shut off after May when we had 150% precipitation in May. We had a really nice runoff. We filled the majority of the reservoirs, and we had a great ski season. And then we slid into the summer with cooler than average temperatures, which we'll take. The only problem was it was really quite dry. We didn't really see much precipitation, and the precipitation we did see came in the form of very damaging thunderstorms. They were intense, they were localized, and they caused all sorts of havoc for a roughly about 2 week period.
Okay, so we'll get to a little bit of that in a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So overall, it was, say, warmer than average and a little definitely drier.
It was actually warmer in August. June was cooler than average.
Right.
July was about average, and then we slid into some pretty hot temperatures in August. But overall, as far as temperature goes, it wasn't too bad all throughout the area, throughout the state for the most part.
Okay. So, any ideas why it was warmer and drier? Did the high pressure ridge set up, unusual conditions?
The feeling was we had such an active pattern that started all the way back from October of last water year that the pattern kind of set up, and it was really quite active all the way through the spring. And it took a while for the pattern to shift to our summer package. And what we saw was the monsoon didn't come really till about the third or fourth week of July. Normally that starts in early July when you see that surge of moisture come up when Mexico gets a low pressure. Pacific moisture pulls up into Mexico, Arizona, and then into Utah. Our pattern was so active that the global pattern, at least in this hemisphere and down by Mexico, couldn't get going until about, you know, July, the third week of July, maybe even in early August. And then we started to see thunderstorms in earnest that were really quite damaging.
All right, so let's talk about those thunderstorms then. You're always... You have kind of like your finger on the button when there's a chance for severe storms and to initiate flash flood alerts, et cetera, right?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
And so when you go back to 2018 in the summer months, we had a very extensive fire season in central Utah with very damaging fires with high-intensity burns. And as a result, these things will kick off debris flows with a smaller amount of rain than they typically see. So it takes about 3 years for these fires to heal up in the watershed before they stop mm-hmm. producing debris flows. So we were worried this year coming into it was the first year that we saw these burn scars come into a monsoonal flow. And when we saw the monsoon was delayed, we kind of waited, and then we saw a surge come into Utah. And we had debris flows off of the Bald Mountain Fire. We had off the Dollar Ridge Fire, which is the Strawberry River leading mm-hmm. into Starvation. We also had a thunderstorm that moved into Little Cottonwood Canyon that produced a debris flow that wasn't even a burn scar. It was massive. It
wow.
had bus-sized pieces of rock that came down. It filled the culverts. It closed the road. And it was a problem because if all the culverts were full, we were worried if we had another round of thunderstorms that produced this kind of intense rainfall that we may have lost the road up Little Cottonwood. The engineers were worried about that. Luckily, we dried out after that. That was early August, and then we really haven't seen much precipitation since then. Bird's Eye on the backside of Bald Mountain had a debris flow. Tank Hollow Burn Scar had a debris flow that blew out their retention structures and went on to US 6 leading from Provo into Soldier Summit. We had an accident on there, and it was all in this very concentrated time where we saw thunderstorms for roughly about 10 days. And then it just stopped, and we haven't seen much of anything since then. But it was a very crazy time. And that Bald Mountain burn scar has some problems where people are built homes right below the burn scar. We had a debris flow there. Luckily, the rainfall intensity and the volume of rain was low enough that we just had debris coming down and damage property, but didn't kill anybody, and that's a concern.
But there can also be a fear when there are thunderstorms not followed by rain. And so what do you say is the percentage of thunderstorms that are followed by rain versus lightning that can cause fires?
You know, once you get those dry lightning events, and we saw a lot of those in the second half of August, it shifts from debris flows to fire starts. And we saw a great number of fire starts, especially along the Wasatch Front and Tooele. We had late season burns, the Green Ravine fire near Tooele, and it would be fine. It wouldn't be a problem. But there's a new development that went in that's a 90-degree angle to the drainage that's going to go in there. The Gun Range fire near Bonneville was a problem. And then we just had the Francis fire, which is a little bit farther north. All three of these burned. They didn't burn that hot, but we still have to monitor these now.
So these areas that experience debris flows, does that mean they're out of the woods, per se, as far as future debris flows, or are they still at risk?
Still at risk. They'll be at risk for 3 years.
Yeah. And it takes 3 years for, the ecology there to recover.
Yeah, it's essentially what happens is when you have a hot fire, the vegetation burns and produces hydrophobic soils. That hydrophobicity acts like a Gore-Tex jacket on the hillside where it increases the runoff down to the lower parts of the drainage, and then it picks up logs, wood, rocks, dirt, and starts moving it. And when you think of the physics of all of this coming down the mountain, it's amazing. Some of the bigger debris flows we've seen have gone in the back of houses, blown right through the house, and not even changed its direction and totally destroyed everything in its path.
Right.
It's all based on rainfall intensity and volume. If you get a little bit of rain, then you get just kind of muddy water. And it's also based on the residence time of the fire. Did it burn hot? Did it burn long?
Right.
And did it burn a lot of the bigger vegetation? If it burned the grass, it's not a big deal, maybe
right.
a year's worth. But we didn't see that. Some of these were really hot burns that are quite frightening.
You've talked about in the past that you're seeing more fires burning hotter.
Yeah. That's what you see as our temperatures increase with climate change, fire activity is increasing, and the timing of the activity is increasing. You know, as we were speaking earlier, usually the fire season in Utah is in the early summer, the monsoon gets here, and then it kind of slows down, and then you see the Pacific Northwest start to burn. We've just had three different fires in late September, mid-September, that we're dealing with right now. It's the entire summer was pushed back about a month from what we typically see just due to the active winter pattern we had.
Right. So the season's not over.
Yeah, right. I
mean, there still could be lightning caused fires that may pop up.
Yeah, and we've got a pattern shift coming up at the end, about 5 days to 7 days, that's going to really get things wet, and hopefully that'll put an end to all our fire behavior. But right now, the fire danger is still quite high.
And what were you saying about the percentage of fires that are caused by people versus lightning?
Yeah, if you look in Utah, 50% of the wildfires are human caused. People just leaving campfires out. They're not paying attention to what they're doing, and it's starting fires. The Gun Range fire was a fire due to people did a little campfire on a road and then drove away while the fire was still burning. It caught fire, and it burned three homes in Bountiful.
Simply because they based on your knowledge, the research you did, or the post mortem, these are people who just basically neglected a fire that they had started.
Yeah, and when I was doing the assessment after the fire, we saw where it was right on the road, and you look, and it was right next to all these dry grasses, and unfortunately, three homes burned in this fire.
Right.
It's half of the fires in Utah are caused, are human caused, not lightning caused.
Wow. Okay. So yeah. Education can, common sense continues to be a challenge.
Yeah.
So that's the fire. So if you just join us, we're speaking with Brian McNerney, senior hydrologist with the National Weather Service. We're talking about the summer temperatures and lack of precipitation. We'll say it's been a very dry summer. It's usually a dry summer. Summers are dry in general, but this was a little extra dry.
Yeah.
Just a couple inches or less of rainfall.
Yeah.
Total. Let's talk about then that influence on our reservoirs and our watersheds. Coming out of the spring, we were here in June. You said things were great, 100%, 110%. All reservoirs were looking healthy. How did they survive the summer?
They actually did quite well when you think of the lack of rain that we've had. And I think that had to do with the temperatures that we saw in June were cooler than average. And then July was roughly average. We didn't get really hot until August. But when you drive around, you see the reservoirs are in pretty good shape for mm-hmm. what we saw. They filled this past runoff season, which was wonderful. We were totally absent of any type of drought designation at the end of that runoff. That's Utah. Now what we see is abnormally dry conditions across the state due to the lack of rain. But I think as far as water supply goes, we're doing well. What you don't want to do is put these back-to-back-to-back years. Then you find that we go into drought pretty bad. And we were some of the worst drought designations in the entire country before the runoff last year. And last year solved all that. We had about 130% precipitation statewide for the 2019 water year, which was wonderful.
Right.
And it stayed cold, so it stayed as snow for quite a long time, and we had a very efficient runoff. All of those things combined took away any drought designations. Now we're kind of sliding back into abnormally dry conditions, hopefully not to have extensive drought.
Again, as you've talked in the past, in a warming world, we're going to see bigger swings from one extreme to the other, whether it's drought-related conditions and then suddenly a well above average precipitation and storm-related conditions, right?
Yeah.
And this is what
If you look at this summer, it was a really good example, the lack of rain throughout the entire summer. And then we had a period of 10 days to 2 weeks where it was quite damaging rain, very intense rain. For every degree centigrade, you raise the temperature, the average temperature, you increase the atmospheric moisture by 7%. So now what we've seen in Utah, we've raised it about 2 degrees Fahrenheit. Where in some areas, we've raised it 3 degrees. That comes with a price where now you have a warmer air mass. It can hold more moisture. So thunderstorms are much more intense, and we're seeing that. Very damaging thunderstorms we saw, even though it was a very short period of time.
So does that suggest then we could be a more humid, wetter Utah?
Yeah, but you have to look at it in the bigger picture. The storms are going to come in these deluges. What we're seeing is thunderstorm activity and rainfall are producing bigger flash floods, bigger rainfall amounts in shorter periods of time, and then followed by long periods of high pressure or a lack of rain. That's our future. When you think of our winter times, the two factors that are going against us are the increased temperature, which is going to slowly erode the snow line away so it goes higher and higher until we won't have snow. Right around 2035 to 2065, studies have shown that areas that are 100% snow covered in the winter will only be 50% or less. And then when you reach by about 2080, 2090, 80% of the snowpack in the western U.S. will be gone. Also, we have a preponderance of high pressure over the west that deflects the storms, and that goes into Canada. These two things are working against us for skiing, for water supply, and really for air quality and when you get inversions with high pressure. That's all in our future.
Is Is anyone there at the National Weather Service kind of mapping and trending that rain-snow line over year? I know that's a tough component to try to put your finger on, you should be able to get a sense of, at this elevation, we're seeing more rain than snow over the events, let's say, over the course of the winter.
Yeah, the National Weather Service provides forecasts and warnings for hazardous weather for 7 days. That's our main mandate. That's what we do. But we also have a co-op program, which are a climate program, where we have volunteer ranchers and farmers and people who live all throughout the state. They take the high pressure and the low pressure, or the high temperature and the low temperature every day, and the precip. And the lady who runs this program was, we had a conversation who indicated that the higher co-op stations, which are kind of considered low as far as mountains go, is seeing more rain, less snow. When you look at the snowtail data in the mountains at this kind of fringe area, about 7,000 feet, 8,000 feet, you see more of the same. If you look at published research that shows that the snow lines are moving up into the mountains, it's starting later, it's melting earlier, and the lower elevations are increasing with the amount of rainfall during the wintertime. That is changing right now. That isn't something in the future, and it's going to continue until we have a rain-driven hydrology in the winter times around here. The ski industry is going to have a really hard time once we start having a bad time putting snow at the base areas, and then eventually, you know, down the road. I think at that point we'll be having so many other problems that the powder skiing, which when I first learned of this maybe 10, 15 years ago, I was really bummed about the powder skiing. It's not going to be nearly as good. And then you really realize the ramifications of what's coming. Powder skiing will be the least of our worries.
Yeah. Skiing at all.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yeah, right?
Right. So last minute or two, we like to talk briefly about global trends.
Right.
Warmer world. July was easily the warmest July ever recorded.
Yeah, globally.
Globally.
Yeah.
And that has lots of influences on everything. And I like to track Arctic sea ice. And so here in August, Arctic sea ice experienced the second lowest extent ever recorded. 838,000 square miles below the 30-year average for that month of August. On August 13th, ice extent dropped below 1.9 million square miles. This had never occurred prior to 2007, but has occurred 10 out of the 12 years since then.
Yeah, it's...
That's a trend.
Yeah, it's what you'd expect. The Arctic is warming faster than the equator, relatively, and it's a signal that we see quite frequent. That area is warming much faster than the rest of the globe.
Yeah, the rate of sea ice decline just for the month of August up in the Arctic over a 30-year period is 11% per decade. So every decade, there's 11% less ice in the Arctic during the month of August. Yeah, I mean, you could probably make similar trends during the entire summer.
But right.
This was just for the month of August.
Yeah.
That's another, this is life. And now that will have an influence on our weather and our climate down here.
Yeah. It's a totally connected system. So all of these changes are making things more difficult to forecast weather. Storms are more intense, so it's more difficult to warn for these things from things we haven't seen before. I mean, the debris flow that came out of Little Cottonwood Canyon was a thunderstorm that just moved up from the valley. And depending if you look at the radar data, it was a 500-year event. And, you know, what are the odds of seeing that? Yet
a 500-year event?
Yeah, based on the radar data that I had. It's hard to get an observation on these, but if you take a look at the radar data and look at what we saw, the radar estimates, it was a 500-year event.
So what? Real quick, what does that mean again, 500-year event?
A 1-year event is 100% chance any day. You know,
in the course of
20% for a 5-year event. We're all the way out to 500, so it's like 0.002 or something
right,
like that.
Right, that the
percent chance of this happening. I mean, if you do the math...
Right.
Math is hard in the morning.
All right. Sorry. The interview was going great until I asked the math question.
Right. But suffice to say, it's something you see very rarely, and we're seeing more of this on a regular basis.
Could we see some more debris flows this weekend?
Yeah, it's a possibility. Mm. The material is all there and waiting. It's all based on rainfall intensity and rainfall volume. So if we get those two components, then we could have more. This is something we see frequently now in a new world of a lot more fires, a lot hotter fires, a lot more debris flows. And the problem is we have more people, so they're building homes farther up along the alluvial fans and up into the mountains that are at risk. That's the biggest problem, because before you would have debris flows come down, and that's how the canyons are formed. But nobody would live there, so the rocks would just kind of stop rolling around and all the mud would stop, and then the canyons are formed. Now we've put houses there, and it's a problem because little kids sleep in the basements of these houses.
Right.
And this is a worrisome.
Okay. Is there a website that people can go and see a map of these debris flow prone areas? People want to learn more about?
I think the state EMS might have this.
Okay.
I know we have it internally, but we do it just for warning operations. We have phone numbers we call, those kinds of things. But I think if you look at the state fire page, they'll have where the recent fires are and where we have burn scars and those kinds of things.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Brian, thanks again, as always.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Great to have you on, and we'll see you sometime in December.
Yeah,
for the fall update or redate or whatever. I have no assessment. We'll call it that. Brian McInerney, senior hydrologist with the National Weather Service. As always, thanks a lot, buddy.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, let's take a break.